I've been playing around with a phrase for the last few weeks, maybe a bit longer than that, playing around with it both in my own personal and spiritual life and also in my professional life. And that phrase reads, "The world is not as it seems." And I don't know if you find yourself in a position similar to the one that I find myself in, but I think right now we live in a particular era of chaos. I'm not really exactly sure when it began, if it started on the morning of September 11th, 2001, or if it began in 2008 when the housing market collapsed and the economy collapsed, or if it began in 2016 when we had a particularly contentious and pernicious election, or if it started day before yesterday. But in the midst of this chaos, and I should say up front, I'm using a little cheat sheet this morning because I know that I'm going to get in trouble. And I am using the cheat sheet because I want to get in trouble for what I intend to say to you rather than just what comes to mind. And so forgive me for using the cheat sheet this morning. But I began to play with this phrase, "The world is not as it seems." And that has taken me on a sort of wonderful, curious, and creative adventure through psychology and neuroscience and through the near entirety of the biblical text itself. I have learned a lot about perception, particularly when it comes to the work of a guy named Dennis Prophet. Dennis Prophet is a psychology and neuroscience professor at the University of Virginia. And Prophet and a guy named Drake Bear came together and took Prophet's research and pressed it into a story called Perception. And the two of them came to the conclusion that there are two particular realities that we find through neuroscience and psychology about perception itself. They probably won't come as a big surprise to you. The first theory that they've established is that perception is embodied, that like the way that we see things in the world is connected to our physical condition and our physical ability. And they execute upon this hypothesis through an experiment that'll be of particular interest to people in Jackson, Wyoming. They take individuals of varying levels of physical fitness and they put them in front of a hill. And they give them the instruction to walk to the top of the hill. And what they have found is what we experience, say, maybe May 15th, when we, those of us who have the great privilege of living in Jackson, begin walking up Snow King for the first time after a long winter. What they find is that the way that we see the hill itself is directly tied to our physical condition. So if you've been skinning up and down Snow King at every lunch break over the course of the winter time, then when you begin walking up Snow King, the hill is just a hill. But if you haven't walked up Snow King since, say, maybe October 1st, and you've taken the winter off, then you literally see the mountain as steeper. They found that when they take that individual, those individuals of differing physical abilities, and they put a 35-pound backpack on them, it changes the way they see the hill again. The mildly conditioned or unconditioned individual wearing a 35-pound backpack sees the hill in front of them as something that they most assuredly will not be able to summit. They discovered something else about perception. That perception is not just embodied, but it's also social. So when they took those individuals who were ill or moderately conditioned and viewed that hill as particularly steep, when they took those individuals and they paired them with someone of similar physical condition, the hill became less steep in their perception. Walking up the hill itself was easier when they were doing it with someone else. They found that when they added the 35-pound backpack to the ill or moderately conditioned human beings who were together, that not only were they able to get to the top of the hill, but they were able to experience what we who live in Jackson call type 2 fun. That there was a sense of well-being and a sense of accomplishment or achievement which came from a task when they were asked to do it by themselves was a task that they were not able to complete. The world is not as it seems has been a phrase that I've been playing with in my mind for the last several weeks. And I didn't just go down the neuroscience or psychology path. I also went back to the sacred story itself. And I started at the very beginning of the story. And what I was trying to measure is like, the world is not as it seems. Is this a message that the sacred story itself is trying to deliver to our thresholds? Because I kind of thought it was. I wasn't clear about why I thought it was, but when I went back to the text, I got, you know, through the first book, Genesis, and into Exodus, and I meet Israel. Israel launching the Exodus, moving out of slavery from Egypt toward the promised land. And if you remember, the idea of being liberated for slavery, the perception that Israel has is a beautiful one, right? One that each is excited about. And the excitement lasts maybe 48 hours. And you know the story. Israel is propelled from slavery into chaos for 4 decades. The world is not as it seems. When Jonah is thrown over the rail of the ship into the raging sea and is swallowed in the mouth and moves into the gut of a fish, Jonah believes to his core that it is over. And 3 days later, Jonah is vomited up on the shores of Nineveh, where he finds himself embodying the mission that God intended to send him upon when he made the announcement to Jonah at the very beginning of the story. 5,000 people spend a long day listening to a teacher in a wilderness area where no grocery store and no convenience store is anywhere in sight. At the end of the day, the teacher's disciples begin to panic. Lord, Lord, wrap the sermon up. These people need to eat. The teacher says, you give them something to eat. And 5,000 people are fed with 5 loaves and 2 fish. The world is not as it seems. At the very center of our story, the very center of our Christian story, on a Friday afternoon, all is lost. All is pain and sadness and suffering and violence and death. And then on Sunday morning, when three caring women show up to a tomb to embalm the body of their teacher and friend, a new reality emerges again. The world is not as it seems. The story itself, the sacred narrative, the way in which we move through life in times of confusion and chaos, tends to continually put a message in front of us that there is more than meets the eye, or that perhaps our eyes and maybe even our hearts play tricks on us. Over the course of the last 2 weeks, when we have listened to the gospel, we've heard the story, a very particular story told from the evangelist Luke's perspective. I added last week's gospel back into this week's gospel so that we might hear it twice, because I didn't preach about it last week, and you just can't read this story without making commentary on this particular story, even though that's the choice that I made last week. This story that we hear is most of the installment of what we call the Sermon on the Mount. In Matthew's gospel, where we hear this story told from a different perspective, we call it the Beatitudes because of all the blessings that come. Luke adds the woes, the curses to the blessings. And that's where we get this idea, the Sermon on the Mount. But we really need to go back to the beginning of the 6th chapter of Luke to get a sense of the gravity, to catch the real vision that the sacred story is trying to communicate to us, but we don't really hear anymore because we've domesticated the story through 2,000 years of institutional retelling. And the story needs to be liberated from our institutional domestication, particularly for us in times of chaos like the ones in which we find ourselves today, because we need powerful, wild, undomesticated stories when the age in which we embody and occupy is chaotic in itself. The very first beat of the 6th chapter of Luke's gospel has Jesus and his disciples, a huge cohort following him already because of his popular message, through a wheat field on a Sunday morning. And as they make their way through the wheat field, they violate a religious law. They eat their breakfast while they're moving through the field by plucking the grains of wheat and consuming them. This is considered against the law. It's work, and work can't happen on Sunday morning. Really, it's Saturday morning, right? But I'm saying Sunday morning for our sake, because here we are on a Sunday morning. What they're doing is not okay. It's breaking the rules. This cohort then enters the church. They come into church that morning. Jesus sees a man with a withered, with a disabled, with an injured hand. And he approaches this man and he heals his hand. This, again, in front of the religious people, is a violation of the religious law. It's work, it's healing work, but you're not allowed to do it on a Sunday morning. And you most assuredly aren't allowed to do it in church on a Sunday morning. He's turning things upside down. And then there's this next beautiful beat of the story that we don't hear because we've beatified these people and we have instituted them and their names are familiar and we think of them as the good guys. But the next beat of the sixth chapter of Luke's gospel, Jesus, out of all of the disciples that are following him, appoints 12 of them. Now, we know their names, right? Peter, James, John, all the ensuing names. But what we don't hear anymore is that the people that Jesus appoints are the exact wrong people. We should hear it. This is where I'm about to get myself into trouble. We should hear the appointment of these 12 apostles as Jesus not appointing a Harvard grad, a Yale grad, a Princeton grad, a Brown grad, a Stanford grad, a Columbia grad, maybe even Cornell. Cornell always gets a bad rap. I'm sure it's a wonderful school. They wouldn't have let me in. We're meant to hear this story in such a way that it would be like, and then Jesus appointed the drag queen. And after the drag queen, he appointed the guy in the red Make America Great Again hat. And then the ensuing 10 was everyone in between. What we are meant to hear in this appointment of eccentrics is none of them were the people we were expecting to be appointed. Up to this point in the story, what we're meant to hear as like moderate religious people, everything that is happening from the very first verse all the way up until he begins preaching the sermon, nothing that he has done is okay. He has turned the world, has turned the way that we see the world upside down. It is not about you and me and what we can get for ourselves. As my friend Hunter says, as I've said a million times, less me, more we. This is a very different way of seeing the world in his age and in our age. It is upsetting, but the world is not as it seems. He begins to preach a sermon where he says, "Blessed are the poor." The people who have less power experience blessing. He says, "Blessed are you if you are sad and grieving some great loss, that your sadness and your position in life is in fact blessed." He says, if you go to bed with a growling stomach, with real hunger pains, you are not excluded from blessing, but rather you are included. He goes on to say in Luke's gospel things that almost always makes Episcopalians really uncomfortable. He says, "Woe to you if you ate so much breakfast that you're not even thinking about lunch." He says to people like me, "Woe to you if your pension is fully funded and you can expect to live out retirement without need of assistance from any other human being." What Jesus is trying to tell us is that the world is not as it seems, that you and I are built not just one for another, but one for another and for God, that there is an interdependent reality that exists alongside our radical individualism, and that if we want to experience real blessing in the world, we will push ourselves counterculturally toward a reality where we know the drag queen needs the MAGA hat wearer, and the MAGA hat wearer needs the drag queen, and everything in between. The world is not as it seems, and this is a radical, heart-forward vision for the way that we embody the faith and the way that we carry through in our lives. The world is not as it seems. He goes on to say, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. You have heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I am telling you that the work before you is to love the person who has taken your eye and to pray for the one who knocked out your tooth. This is a radically different way of viewing the world and the way that we embody our lives within it. We have heard it domesticated by the institution. We even read the Beatitudes. What the Sermon on the Mount is one of the suggestions for the wedding readings. And I'm like, oh no, no, no. And then you're like, maybe, right? Those of us who have been married a while, maybe, maybe so. But only through the lens of the world is not as it seems. I stumbled upon this great quote this week, and oh, I should say something before I say that. And this is important. Don't hear what I'm not saying. I'm not saying that poverty doesn't exist. Not saying that injustice doesn't put down people's power and build other people's power up over and against them. I'm not saying that people don't suffer and even die from hunger. I'm not saying that we as human beings on this planet don't experience real suffering, sadness, and grief from loss. All of those things are real, and all of us have agency in our lives to meet folks who are engaged in that hard struggle. So don't hear what I'm not saying from this very privileged place that I preach from. I'm acknowledging a sad reality about the world in which we live. But I am trying with all of my heart to embody the meta-narrative of the story itself that begins in the very first story where God sows goodness into every aspect of creation, and then every story that cascades downstream from that, where we human beings tend to mess things up and God tends to respond with grace, with this pervasive, unreasonable love without condition. I stand before you meaning to say that I know that the suffering exists, but I know that that love comes alongside it and obscures it in such a way that goodness and graciousness can become pervasive in the culture in which we find ourselves. sometimes this life can be lonely. It can be lonely for me. And I know it can be lonely for you. And I stumbled upon this wonderful James Baldwin quote this week. And somebody asked me after the 8 o'clock service, they were like, "Bill Baldwin, tell me about him." And I'm like, "You don't know about Baldwin? Like, oh my God. He's a prophet. He's a beautiful, eccentric prophet." Baldwin wrote, "You think your pain and heartache are unprecedented in the history of the world. And then you read." I love that. Church, if I could leave you with one thing this week, I'll leave you with this. Read. Read the stories. Read your Bible. Don't read it like we read it in the Episcopal Church. One small segment of a scene disconnected from the other scenes. Read this book from the beginning to end and read it through the lens in which it was meant to be read. Through the lens of love, an unreasonable, a pervasive, a beautiful love without condition. Amen.